Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about the Black Lives Matter movement in the Donald Trump era. Is there a change in strategy? We're talking about it with Eugene Puryear, organizer of the Stop Police Terror Project and participant of the Black Lives Matter movement, and Aaron Shields, co-chair of the Black Youth Project 100, the D.C. chapter. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Kathy, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Kathy. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to respond to Mr. Puryear's reference to the NEAR Act. I represent citizens of the District of Columbia, and I can tell you that the majority of my constituents do not support a controversial component of the NEAR Act, which is paying people not to commit crimes. I mean, we need real strategies. My community used to be known as Murder Central, but over the years, we have worked very collaboratively with the police, with our D.C. government, federal partners, you know, to really make our community stronger, safer, and more livable. And we are making, you know, our community is now sought after. So we don't need to pay people not to commit crimes. And I think there needs to be a policy shift, one that includes constructive policing. We want community policing. We want policing that is accountable, respectful, and that's largely what we have. We don't have people getting shot and killed by police in the district falsely like we're seeing throughout the rest of the country.
And if I may, that controversial component comes out of Richmond, California, where it had seen some kind of some various levels of success. But, you know, NEAR Act notwithstanding, can you at least, you know, address the more holistic issue that she is talking about the kind of policing that will make the community safe instead of fearful?
Well, absolutely, and I appreciate the call from Commissioner Henderson. And let me just say again, I mean, this is not just a fake program. It's fact-based, and in multiple cities, again, 40% to 70% reduction in violence, 76% reduction in murders in Richmond, California. So I think those are big results, good results, and if someone is being able to have those kind of results on issues of community violence, we should be looking to it. I do agree, though, that generally we have to be holistic, but I think holistic not just on the issue of how policing is happening, but I think we're far too reactive about what goes on. I mean, there's a spike in murder or robberies or whatever it may be, and people say, well, toughen the penalties and put more cops on the street, and we've seen that not only has it not really affected it, but just the thing keeps going in cycles. And I think we have to look at, as Ron Moten often says to me, hurt people hurt people. And I think we have to look at what is happening. How do we have such broken communities and individuals who are either, you know, acting in a predatory manner, feel like they're forced to do certain things, whatever it may be, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, if it's hurting other people, how do we get ahead of the curve on this? How do we look at issues of unemployment? How do we look at issues of generational trauma? How do we look at issues of what are the overall impacts to children in communities and how they're coming up and how they're being raised? What about issues of housing and so on and so forth? I mean, how do we start to heal communities so that we aren't always talking in these 5 and 10 year cycles about whether we need tougher penalties or more police officers?
Okay. Ms. Henderson, thank you so much for calling. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lennox, calling from Lanham, my hometown. What's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going?
Just fine.
Just wanted to say, you know, it was struck me that when the Black Lives Matter first came out, it was focused solely on addressing police behavior towards black men and women. And now, since it has come along, it seems grown and got some media content, it seems to have become this mission creep, I guess, is the best way to describe it, because it has so many different entities about what's happening. I looked at the website, and to look at the website, it's trying to reach into every little single aspect of, I think, black life and getting away from its main focus, which was looking at addressing the police. I think that the woman who just spoke, Kathy, I love the ideas that she had just talked about. And I think that looking at these things need to be addressed. But if they're talking about every other issue, how is that effective?
Well, and Aaron, you actually spoke about that early in this conversation. And just for a little context, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, and you know better than I, that it was somewhat organic in that, you know, what was happening in Ferguson, Missouri may not have necessarily been happening in Seattle or in Chicago. And it was not like an Urban League or an NAACP where it was centrally located.
Decentralized.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was a decentralized movement. But you did say in the beginning of this conversation that last year or whenever, that there was a move to kind of at least centralize that purpose and be more politically active. And that's the thing that Lennox is talking about.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. So we definitely wanted to, I think a lesson that we learned from the previous iteration of the Black Liberation Movement is to keep things more decentralized. I think we'd like to call our movements leaderful and not leaderless. But to the caller's point, we have broadened the scope of what we look at, and I think that's for the better and not for the worse. I mean, if you're looking at the way that policing and housing interact in D.C., the city spends three times as much on police and prisons as it does on affordable housing in the city. Those two things cannot be delinked from one another. And the way that gentrification or displacement works in the city depends heavily on policing. If they can't price you out of a community, they will police you out of it. And so it makes sense for our communities to be, for these different struggles to be linking to each other, same way in Detroit. So who comes and shuts off your water, or who comes to put you out of your house, or who, you know, like these mechanisms are in my mind inextricably linked to police. And also what we invest in. So when we're investing a lot of money into policing, there are other things that are under invested in. So similar to the point around housing here, there are, when you invest in police or when you spend money on jails, and our chapter in Durham is fighting an $81 million new police station, what goes unfunded, or what could we do with that $81 million? How could we provide housing? How could we provide, living, thriving wages for people? Those types of things, in my mind, stop crime, not police. Police are reactive to crime. That we're always going to have crime if we're not investing in our communities. But
symptomatic.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the misconceptions people have, is they think, oh, well, they hate all cops and they think all cops are bad. I would actually say it's the reverse. I think that we feel that, you know, it's systematic. It's symptomatic of things that are going on in communities, and that really police are managing the contradictions of all the problems that we have. I mean, everything that happens for a reason. Even if someone said, man, that was crazy, why would they do that? Well, I mean, crazy might not be a great term, but it's a reason. And so what's going on? Like, why are there so many mentally ill people roaming around the streets without things that are happening? Why are people, say, maybe outside doing something like smoking weed somewhere instead of like in Ward 3 in someone's house? Well, if you're living in your aunt's house and she's like, hey, you got to get out of here, you know, 7 to 5 and look for a job, and you go and you look for a job, you've done applied to three places, and now you're just hanging out. Well, you can't go back to her house because she's trying to help you out and, you know, putting some rules on you. It is her place. You're outside, you're hanging out with your friends, something happens, all of a sudden the police roll up, you got a ticket. Now, if I'm a Catholic university student and my parents are paying for me to have an apartment off of Michigan Avenue in Northeast, we could do whatever we want to do. The police are never going to see us. And so I think that's where we look at, is that a lot of this stuff and all the other issues are really the roots of these problems that the police are then called in to sort of contain in communities.
Lennox, thank you so much. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to ask you about this, Eugene, because it seems that right when big cities like Baltimore, Chicago were beginning to turn around with police reform, then we have a new president, we have a new attorney general. Attorney General Jeff Sessions wanted to review these consent decrees. And I can tell you, you know, were it not for that, the federal judge in Baltimore that said, we're going to go ahead with the dissent decree, but also with the support of the police commissioner in Baltimore and the mayor, were it not for that perfect storm, arguably, we could have seen a pre-Freddie Gray kind of situation. Are you concerned that other cities that don't have that kind of reform-minded leadership, political leadership, may be powder kegs waiting to explode.
Oh, I'm very concerned about that. I mean, and I think that honestly what Jeff Sessions has done is he's basically given people an out, because since they know they're never going to have anything from the Justice Department, or even if they do get something from the Justice Department, that it's not going to be terribly rigorously enforced. They're not going to be there checking every box. And there's questions that can be raised about how effective consent decrees are. But at the end of the day, I think obviously this has heavily lessened the even thought of accountability in the minds of, I think, many local police officers. And I think it's hard to understate that Jeff Sessions is, even out of the quote-unquote Republican mainstream, he was the only person on the Senate Judiciary Committee, including all the other Republicans, to be opposed to mandatory minimum reform. He's now trying to say that they should review the guidance that was given to U.S. attorneys. And these are things that not, like, quote-unquote radicals are pushing. This is stuff that Bob Goodlatte, the Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee, was like, we must do this. This is an extremely unfair system. And so I think for sure, I'm very concerned that we are in a climate where the Justice Department is going to be looking to really actually maybe even increase the belief of police that they can go out and brutalize people without consequences.
You were going to say something, Erin?
You know, I'm going to say this. I'm just going to put this on the table. I am not convinced that police departments can be reformed.
Why do you
say that? I
think
because when you look at the history of policing and what policing is rooted in, you cannot... When there's blood at the root, so it's never going to bear good fruit, if that makes sense. Like, the system isn't going to tell on itself. So, like, any reforms from the DOJ or any, like, no police department is going to tell on itself, anything like that. And also, like, the system was built to contain black bodies, to manage black bodies, to surveil black bodies, black and brown bodies. And you can't reform out of that. You can't reform racism out of something. You can't, like, you can only steal power from it. You can't abolish it. You can transform it into something that truly serves our communities.
Well, what's the difference between transform and reform?
So a reform, so we talk about this a lot in organizing. So there's reformist reforms, funny term, and then there's abolitionist reforms. So reformist reforms are like body cameras, for instance. So they give more money to police. They further entrench the system of policing, and they don't actually lead to more convictions. Like, we see black people getting killed on body cameras all the time. It spreads images of black people being killed on, you know, on camera, but it doesn't actually lead to more convictions or more, you know, justice.
Well, so some could argue that what's happening in Balk Springs is a direct result of that reform, Balk Springs, Texas, and the shooting of Jordan Edwards, where the officer in question was immediately fired, and then a couple of days later, he was arrested, he was charged, and so some would argue that at least in some small way, those kinds of things are working. And even as we've seen in with vehicle cams in Chicago, you know, were it not for those vehicle cams, there would not be the pending court cases now of unarmed black men being shot. So some would argue against that.
I would say, so to me, this shifts what we should be focusing on. So it feels like to me and a lot of the organizers that I work with that we are spending a lot of energy, particularly because of the ways that these laws are passed, fighting to get footage released. We spend a lot of organizing energy trying to get footage released. And then it doesn't actually end in what one might consider justice. Sure, indictments may be made, but that doesn't actually mean that, you know, that anything is going to come of that, like we've seen in many cases. And so I'm interested in how we can, I don't know how radical this sounds to people who are listening, but like how we can steal power away from these systems that have, since the beginning, there has never been a time when police have kept black people safe. They're like, that has never happened. And so how can we steal power from these systems and actually invest in our communities? How can we stop thinking of police as mental health practitioners and actually invest in mental health and put mental health community centers in our neighborhoods? Like,
I got to take a break.
No, go ahead. Sorry. I got to get
fired up, ready to go. Troy in College Park, Yvonne and Bowie, we're going to talk to you after the break. Stay with us. Don't hang up. We'll be back in a moment. We're talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, what's happening with it right now. This is the Inside segment on Sirius XM Channel 141.
The Karen Hunter Show.
Back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the Black Lives Matter movement today. What's happening with it? Troy calling from College Park. Thanks for calling, Troy. What's on your mind?
Good day, Harold. I love that last comment, by the way, about the can't reform the police, need to completely dismantle and deconstruct it. But I think Black Lives Matter and the rest of anybody else that's interested in black activism, black liberation, needs to refer to Powernomics, the book by Dr. Claude Anderson, which just talks about how we need to build black wealth and build black economics, because that is the core of all issues, whether it's mass incarceration, the political education, the media. If you don't build black wealth and we can't have our own institutions, then the things that will continue to happen, all the injustice will continue to happen, and you cannot protest your way. And hope the power structure is just going to give you some leeway. You need to create your own police force, your own media, your own political system, and trying to do things that continue to not work for the past 60 years is a waste of our time, and lives are being lost and ruined in the process. So I think Black Lives Matter needs to go back to the drawing board, and, you know, like we're having an African Liberation Day celebration in D.C. at the Union Temple Church, May 27th, and we're going to talk about how to fight imperialism and, you know, capitalism, and really deconstruct the whole system that way.
Okay.
We can really liberate our people and take power back.
Well, Troy, thank you so much for your phone call. Eugene, you have anything to say about what Troy was sharing?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I just start with this. I mean, the only group I know of black people who have tried very aggressively, really two groups that have tried very aggressively to create their own nation within a nation here, the Republic of New Africa, who was brutally repressed when they tried to create a black country. Certainly the Nation of Islam, which has been heavily under FBI investigation for many years. Obviously Malcolm X, even after he left, but similar sort of idea of nationhood and nationalism. I think similar with Amiri Baraka and the Congress of African People and the moves they made, and when they started to move towards more radical ideas of breaking from the system, marginalized, attacked, demonized, arrested, and so on and so forth. So I don't think there's any other way to move forward any sort of major agenda of significant change for black people in America without contesting the fact that the government, the state, is not a neutral actor, it's not a neutral force, and it's never allowed the most visionary black movements in this country, from Martin Luther King to many others, to ever really emerge in their full fledged reality. I mean, we talk so much, for example, about the issues of black women now, which I think is a great thing that the movement for black lives has brought forward. Well, what about someone like a Claudia Jones, who in 1947, 48, 49 is talking about what it means to be a working class black woman in America? They deported her into England, where she was marginalized and attacked, and so on and so forth. And so we see so significantly that as much as people, and as much as there are some, I think, valid and invalid points in what was said, I think the bigger issue is that we're not going to have any sort of broad transformative agenda that doesn't have a direct political engagement and perhaps confrontation with the existing American governmental system.
Back to, you know, something that was mentioned early in this conversation, you know, with the federal Justice Department not filing civil rights charges against the officers in the Alton Sterling case. Obviously, the state of Louisiana, that's still kind of up in the air as to whether or not those officers will be prosecuted. But you may also remember that 2 months later, you know, Gavin Long went on a shooting spree and shot 6 officers, killed 3. It was reported that he was upset about the Alton Sterling situation. When we have those kinds of retaliatory situations, and that's just one, there have been others, does that cause problems, you know, for the movement's argument, or does it go back to not so much the issue of retaliatory black on white crime, or is it just about economics and trying to get black folks in the community to think a different way?
I think when you see retaliatory
is it just an isolated thing?
Yes and no. I think it is representative of people's lack of investment in what in black people finding justice in this country. Similar to like all sort of protest movements, when you feel like you cannot get justice the legitimate way, that that will never be delivered to you. I think people to varying extremes may seek out justice in different ways. It is a difficult, I don't know, because I didn't have a chance to talk to the person. I don't know why he did that, but I would imagine that that time was a very volatile time. I mean, we were talking about earlier about how, you know, there were shootings weekly on the news, big national shootings weekly on the news, with seemingly no recourse for the officers that were brutalizing our communities. And so what I would imagine is somebody seeing that, and also, I mean, there's a bit of there's a lot of stuff, but a bit of toxic masculinity in there too, about people not having ways of expressing their frustration in nonviolent ways and whatnot. But I mean, Eugene, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I'm surprised that these situations like the shootings in Dallas and Louisiana don't happen more often. I mean, I'm not condoning it, but I mean, mm-hmm. you know, if you go back and you read the sociology literature about black people, we've been complaining about police brutality going back to the turn of the century when people like St. Clair Drake and W.E. Du Bois are really starting to study these large growing black populations in major urban areas. I mean, in just, you know, about 1,000 people killed a year. So that's about 17,000 people killed by police since 2000. Most of them black and brown. I'm pretty sure at least a large, certainly very disproportionate minority of them relative to our percentage in the population. And then we don't continually really see any form of justice. And if anything, that's a testament to black America, quite frankly, because I think that honestly, if you look at the racist disparities, and I mean, you had a black president who said that I don't speak out as much on race because I found that it wasn't actually helpful. And whether you like it or whether you don't, I mean, what a profound statement. I mean, when is any president of the United States ever not felt like they could use their bully pulpit on any major issue, but just by the virtue of him being black, it was like it devalued the conversation that he brought to the table, whether people thought it was sufficient or insufficient. I just think it speaks to the deep level of racism in this country, and I think that it is isolated right now because I think most black people are like, let's do something else, but mm-hmm. I do think that it also speaks to the urgency of the issue, that eventually, that if this continues the way it is, I think future generations perhaps will be much less forgiving.
And speaking of the future, and this is for both of you, as Aaron spoke about the kind of change in strategy, and if I close my eyes and I didn't see you, and if I didn't know that this was something that was happening recently, I could have said that you were with the Urban League or you were with the NAACP. But hold on. This is why I say that. It's because they have been focusing on those things, or at least in their discussions. Is this a maturing of Black Lives Matter, where it's no longer just about the marching, but the economics and about the community, and is there a place for a summit with the likes of the venerable Urban League or NAACP, or will Black Lives Matter always kind of remain the tip of the spear, but going in a different direction?
So I think most organizations that are working within the movement for Black Lives are running an outside game, and I would consider NAACP Urban League more of an inside game. Mm-hmm. And why I say that is because why I kind of like was like, whoa, when you said that, I sound like I could be NAACP, is because BYP 100 and the organizations that we work with are, you know, expressly abolitionist. Most of us are abolitionists in nature and will argue for, like I said, the dismantling of the police, which is radical to a lot of people, but seems like the only option for us. And so maturing in terms of we are deepening our work in areas of policy, but still radical in the sense that what that policy looks like isn't necessarily body cameras, but it is community control over the police, not community policing. We don't need to further embed police in our communities. We need control over the police that, you know, roam around our communities and, you know, mm-hmm. I have harass people. You know, I have different experiences with police than some of the other callers. But and so we are reaching to our black, you know, our black legal scholars and our, mm-hmm. our radical black legal scholars and our radical public policy folks to say, hey, how can we get control over police budgets? Mm-hmm. How can we, what type of legislation, what does it look like to have legislation where we can have hiring and firing power in our communities over like police officers as a tool of accountability towards abolition, not as its angle itself.
And let me say that, and I want Eugene, he's got about 30 seconds and I want him to chime in, but what I'm hearing is today's radical is tomorrow's mainstream.
Well, if we do our job right, I think that would be the case, that we move our just in. So I'd like to say I'm like with that Ella Baker, Rosa Parks, Robert F. Williams, NAACP, which I wish they would remember a little bit more of that. But I think the other issue that we're also grappling with in the movement for Black Lives is the issue of money and funding, which has been a huge issue for Black organizations over time. NAACP, National Urban League have gone the corporate funding route. I think there's a lot more to say about that. I think we're looking at how do we have more of, I might say, the church-based model of really a community, people in community supporting the institutions they want and helping them build up the type of capacity they need.
Which is where it kind of all began. Mm. Yeah. So I want to thank both of you, Eugene Puryear and Aaron Shields. So nice to meet you, Aaron. Just wonderful, wonderful big brain sister. You keep doing what you're doing. Eugene, always good to see you, man.
Thank you,
sir. Take care. That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, May 10th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can follow me on Twitter at HFisher, WHUR, or at Daily Drum, WHUR. Now, stay tuned for the connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU, and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR.